Welcome to Life After Business, the podcast that helps you understand how to increase the value of your business, what your company is worth, and what your exit options are. Host Ryan Tansom and his guests give you all the information you need to get clarity and control over your business and take pride in a valuable company that gives you freedom and choices to exit on your terms.
Welcome back. This is episode 187, and I appreciate you tuning back in. Today, we're going to be talking about why you should be happy with all the money you get up front if you sell to a private equity firm or honestly any buyer, and why really diving in as much as you possibly can to understand why the different buyers want to purchase your company. Because every buyer buys for their own reasons, and they're not going to tell you because they have a reason to fork over a bunch of money to purchase your company. And the reason they don't want to tell you is because the moment that you know what the biggest motive is for them to purchase your company, you're going to have leverage over them in the deal. And because of how difficult it can be to truly understand all of the dynamics of what's happening with the buyer and behind the scenes of why they want to purchase your company, it is crucial that you get as much cash as you possibly can up front. Hopefully you built a really good, valuable business that allows you to get that much, as much money as you possibly can up front, but at least get as much up front where you're happy with it and it hits your personal financial targets, because you don't know whether you're going to get the earnout or get the rolled equity, because everything changes when it's no longer your business. Today on the show, I have Todd Eberhardt, who has grown and sold a couple multi-million dollar companies, and he had double-digit growth in one of his big companies that he ended up selling called ComWorks. And he started the company, they bootstrapped it, used their own money, bought out a couple partners, and then had very rapid double-digit growth for years. And Todd shares with us how he was talking with his partner about, when are we going to realize this value, as they kept plowing money back into the business. And he talks about how cash is a huge suck for a growing business. And they kept wondering, like, when are we going to be able to take some chips off the table? So they started talking to some investment bankers, and he discusses some of the things that they did to decouple themselves from the business and then help the company propel its growth. But then what they were doing as they tried to take the company to market with a couple investment bankers, and then what they did to eventually sell the business to a private equity firm. And he talks about his major lessons learned and how one of his biggest takeaways is that every buyer buys for their own reasons. He's going to share what it was like selling to a private equity firm and then what ended up happening after they sold, as he really truly understood the motives of the PE firm, and then what happened after the board changed hands, and then what that ended up doing to him and his role and his journey post-closing. Todd's amazing. I love his story. He's super authentic, and he shares how he doesn't regret a single thing, but there's a lot of lessons that he learned, and he was willing to share them with you on the show today. There's two things I want you to do. One is, if you got any more feedback on changing the title of the podcast to Intentional Growth, how to grow the value of your business with the end in mind, please shoot me a LinkedIn message or an email. Otherwise, the second piece would be, check out one of our 2-day intentional growth boot camps based on the 5 principles, where it's 2 days jam-packed based on our 2 case studies about how they understood what their company was worth, navigated their education on all the different exit options, and then put a value growth plan in place to accomplish what they wanted from their business and why they were able to accomplish that. So without further ado, here's my interview with Todd.
Sponsored by Arcona's Growth and Exit Boot Camps, 2 days jam-packed with material on the 5 growth and exit principles and the world of mergers and acquisitions. You'll walk away knowing exactly what steps to take to get your target valuation and your best exit option. 2 days at Arcona's Boot Camp will give you the clarity to control the rest of your journey as an entrepreneur.
Todd, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Ryan. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm looking forward to it. We got both fellow podcasters, and I'm going to be on yours here pretty soon. And I don't know how many you become a guest on, but I've been on probably 2 recently, and it's really weird because it's more nerve wracking, I think, than actually just asking questions and letting someone else talk. So we'll see. I don't know if you had the similar experience, but
it's 100% very unnerving being on the other side of it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, what are they going to ask? Am I going to be prepared? And it's like, no, we're just going to be talking about your story. So unless you're talking about someone else's story, you should be just fine. So, you and I got introduced by a couple of mutual connections, and you've got a couple different exits that you've gone through, and you're helping business owners right now. So just, I had an absolute blast talking to you. So for the listeners, what's set the groundwork here? And maybe just give them a cliff note version of what you're doing today, some of the things of your story, and then I want to hear how did you decide to start the company that you eventually sold, and we can kind of then start from the beginning.
Okay, we'll start with today and back up from there if that works.
Yeah, perfect.
Today is Dynasty Leadership. So this is the sixth company. They've all been startups. Nothing sexy with VC funding, all bootstrap kind of things. Dynasty, it's a real simple business. I coach CEOs and their executive teams, and I facilitate strategic planning for the companies that are looking to grow through innovation. So pretty simple world. If we back up and go for the other companies, it started in 1995 with a company called Comworks here in the Twin Cities.
How'd you start it? Like, was it accidental or was it on purpose or...
So we all three worked, the three partners, so Jeffrey Jacob, Al Lampe, who's still CEO today at Comworks, myself did a short stint at another company. That was more of a lifestyle business. And within about 3 months, you kind of figured, this isn't really going anywhere. And I said, you know what, guys, I'm going to go do something else. And that's when we got to talking and had a few beers and said, you know what, we can go do something that is going to kind of mimic the world we want to move to and give us some control over our lives, let us pay some bills with the family and move forward. And that was what kicked it off.
That's awesome. I like how you said mimic the world we want to look in, or we want to create. Because like, I think there's so many times when we talk about, what do you want from your business? And it's like people just, the business is like a way to, build the business, build the life that you want. And it ends up coming with a lot of responsibility. And so give us the overview of what Comworks was, and then, and what year was it? And what were some of the first things that you guys started doing?
So Comworks was, if you think about it, it's like a general contractor for the technical world, right? So 1995, 96 was a fast-moving time when a lot of companies were starting to network all of their field offices. So if you think about like a Best Buy, now we take it for granted. But at the time, if you check out, the register and said, well, you guys are out of big screen TVs, from Panasonic. And they're like, oh, wait a minute. I know we don't have it in Minnetonka, but I can see right here, we got it in Ridgefield. You want me to hold it for you? Well, that takes a lot of technology connected. And back then, that was not the thing. So what companies would call us to do was to say, hey, we have these 50 stores or these 20 bank branches or whatever. And said, make them all look and act the same with technology. So we would go out, and rather than using our own people, we connected a bunch of subcontractors that worked under our flag. And, you roll them all up, and over time, I think we ended up with, about 4,000, 5,000 subcontractors across the country.
Along that, I'm just curious, when you three started, I'm kind of, we can ebb and flow between the actual operations and then also the back end structure.
Sure.
When you had three of you, and I don't know if this will probably tie into eventually when you exited and how that all worked between you three, because you said one of them still running the business, is like, what was the spirit of the partnership? Did you guys really rock solid, nail down the operating agreement and roles, responsibilities, or was it run and gun and let's go install projects and then that all came later? What was the dialogue like with you three?
So there's kind of two separate sides to that. One is the structure, let's just say the legal documentation, mm-hmm. and the other is how does the business run in real life.
For all you attorneys out there, right?
Yeah. Now, I'll say this, I'll give huge credit to our attorney, Bob Christensen, and our accountant, John Dodge, that helped us set up something really solid. And they gave the best advice, which was, hey, get these details nailed down while you guys are still friends, still talking to each other, because sooner or later, you're going to get in trouble. And you hope you never look at this, but you probably will. And so right away, we actually got good advice, which part of that was a buy-sell agreement. And we can talk about that as we go, mm-hmm. Because one of our partners did exit. how it worked functionally is very different. When you're just three guys, you know, we were in a tiny little office in Crystal, Minnesota, subleasing a place, and we were so frightened that a client might actually show up at our door. We actively only sold to the furthest places possible, to like California, New York, Texas. We were literally ready to hatch a brick that somebody was going to walk through the door and see how tiny we were.
That's awesome. So did you guys have the, when you say like the role, like reality versus the legal docs too? Because like, so would we talk about this a lot of this concept versus ownership versus W-2 role and responsibility, right? And,
yeah.
And you know, when you got three of you, I don't know if you were all three, a third. And then how did you guys start divvying up the roles and relationships or like the ongoing management stuff?
Yeah, so it was a third. We all kind of threw in and we didn't know any different. You know, honestly, if I had to take a lesson learned out of that, you probably want to figure out how much each one is willing to do and what they're bringing to the table and make that be the, you know, the percentage, and probably only count, you know, maybe no more than half your equity early, and the rest of it we'll figure out as we kind of grow into the business. That's one of the things I think about a lot.
So like you three would have like each split 50%.
Yeah. And then, pick a number that's less than 100, because you're going to have to allocate resources and capital, because someone eventually does more. Someone has a bigger role, and sometimes people want to step back and maybe you'll get a new partner. And there's all kinds of other things that in the beginning we never think about. So, but I mean, for us, we started with a subchapter S Corp, a third. And then I was the guy cold calling. And Al was the guy, once I sold it, he would make things happen. And then Jeffrey was the guy that was financed to make sure we got paid. So that was the simple world.
Very, very good roles. Like all of those extremely necessary.
Yeah. That was helpful. So, you know, in the beginning though, so the reality is though, until you get good customers, everybody's trying to make contacts, make sales. So we're all helping with that. And then like every small business, you get overwhelmed. All of a sudden, you got all this business, and now we're all trying to create, you know, work orders and projects and things like that. And then we got to figure out how do you get it built. And so, it is a lot like watching somebody try to squeeze a balloon. You know, it's you take care of bits and pieces at a time.
So, you know, now that you do strategic planning, you've gone through a couple exits. You know, going back to that point, like, what was the plan? Like, and maybe kind of give us some like timelines and some like, you know, milestones in the business as you guys were growing. Like, what was the plan? Was it just grow and make money? And like, what was like, was there, had anybody ever been through an exit, like, or starting with the end in mind, or what was the dialogue like?
It was a zero experience crowd. We had no preconcept of what an exit would look like. It would have probably been hugely helpful had some of the strategic planning options been available out there. One of your boot camps would have been nice. You know, things like that where you kind of are more mindful about what creates value. To be brutally honest, so I had this conversation with my wife, Leslie, the other day. We were kind of talking about this. And she goes, do you remember how excited we were once the business started? And our whole goal was to let her go to part-time, you know, just to make enough money so that we could have a life together, pay for a house, have some freedom, and have, you know, be able to do the things we wanted to do. So it was much more about the freedom than some big golden parachute at the end. But I would say it was probably a much more simpler focus that we had.
So as you like, which you said a lot there that I think is interesting, because, you know, I think a lot of people like start the business for that freedom, but then you mentioned that also it would have been interesting to know about what creates value long term. And I think there's this challenge of like people striving towards profits. First of all, when you're growing, it growth consumes capital, so you're actually having to burn more cash than probably most people think. and then as you're growing, you're not having as much cash.
You're 100% right.
Go into that, because I'm curious, because like it's just like value creation is at the end, but that's like a 10-year. Well, now I have a valuable business that gives me options, but like the path in between is just extremely difficult.
Yeah. So a couple of thoughts on that. You're 100% right. A growing business is such a hungry animal for cash. And because we didn't have outside capital, it was our cash. And so, you know, really, we didn't take any paychecks. I think in like the eighth month, we were profitable right out of the gate because it was super lean. But we didn't even take any kind of cash out until the eighth month. And that was just to pay taxes. And so we were kind of riding off our spouses the whole way. And they would be looking back at us like, this is going to work out, right? This is going to happen. And we're like,
yeah. Trust me.
Yeah, for sure. But you know, that's one of those things that you think about now in retrospect is, the honest truth is, Ryan, we were never poorer than when the business was growing. But on the outside, everybody sees this fast growing business and we're hiring people along the way. And, you know, they see big client names and all these other things. And they think, geez, these guys got to be rolling in it. And it's just not the case.
So yeah, it is so true. I interviewed Jack Stack, who's the founder of the Great Game of Business. And he was actually instrumental into creating the Inc. 5000, Todd. And he said that out of the Inc. 5000, and he's all about creating value, like with his the grandfather of open book management and ESOPs. And he's like, at the Inc. 5000, he goes, less than half of these people can afford two payrolls.
For real? That's crazy.
And he's like, because they're all growing so fast. And he goes, they're so broke, cash broke, that, and like everybody gives him all this recognition. He actually like got so sick of it. That's why he actually ended up bowing out of it, because he was like, he thought that everybody was getting rewarded for the wrong things.
Yeah. And he makes a good point is it's flashy on the front side and it feels good that you're growing. It doesn't talk at all about what the long-term profitability is. And, you know, I think about it. One of the things we thought about a lot is as we grew, you know, you get 100, 200 people on the payroll, you know, depending on how many family members are involved in that, you know, you have quite potentially 100 plus families depending on you that they're going to make their rent check, that they're going to buy groceries. That becomes a lot of responsibility.
So as you're building that responsibility, I'm curious, like, what was the kind of the path of growth, or like the pace of growth? And then as you were doing that, you said that you know, you had this buy sell agreement. So like, you know, how did you handle the partnership issues of people not doing the same thing? Cause again, we talk in the bootcamp, it was like, everybody can have different owners, right? But then usually they're bringing something to the table, whether it's capital or sweat equity or, you know, something. And then you've got W-2. So you have, like you said, sales, marketing, finance, and then operations. But as those, you know, those actual W-2 roles evolved, how are you guys handling those conversations as like who's pulling what weight, and how did that correlate to ownership conversations?
Yeah. So as we grew, and again, there's tons of lessons along the way, which, you know, when we say lessons, what it really means is we made a mistake and we figured out what we have to do to fix that. So I don't want to candy coat the fact that we had all these answers. But, you know, so you talk about a path to growth. We worked with large companies, you know, and it sounds sexy, but the reality is you make 400 cold calls, you're going to get hung up on 399 times. And because they all have stuff going on and they all have a plan. U.S. Bank did not get to be the size they are by waiting for Todd Eberhardt to give him a call, right? So, you know, you're breaking into someone else's world. You're taking money out of someone else's pocket. So early on, if you talk about strategy and path to growth, we kept getting blocked. And what we had to come up with is what is going to work that's going to get their attention. And so, you know, after a number of different trials, we came up with a very simple statement, which is give us your worst. Give me your crappiest site. Give me the one that if it fell off the face of the earth tomorrow, it couldn't get worse than it is today. So they would send us to places like Tonawanda, New York and Osage, Iowa to do these crazy things as a test. And we earned some credibility, but it wasn't like we won these big RFPs. It was little by little and scratching and clawing our way up there. So not super sexy, but that's in reality the way things worked. If you evolve into the question of partnership and division of responsibilities, now you start to talk about, okay, well, as the business grows and you start to add people more than just worker bees, how do you start to move that around? And we did stay with that same thing. I stayed heading up sales, Al headed up operations, and Jeffrey stayed with finance. And I'll give you the honest truth, which is I waited way too long to let go of doing the sales because it was fun and it was going and we were making money and I was good at it. But it's not uncommon. So the guys I coach today, letting go of some things, delegating in the right way. Right. It was that was a learning lesson. Once I started adding other salespeople around me, we made them successful. And I realized, God, we waited way too long for that. And then I waited way too long to add management. And I should have done that sooner because, honestly, not a great manager. Great leader, not a great manager. And so then we started adding managers, and then everybody started doing better. And we did that, you know, I would say Al's probably a better delegator and better manager holding over people, but everybody's got their own strengths. And so we kept going. Once we effectively started figuring out good ways to delegate and add people and add talent, things kept growing exponentially. And I'd combine that with what I would call a rule of fives, which was a strategy, which was super helpful in the growth.
So I want to get into the rule of fives because I'm curious on what that is. But before we do that, you know, I think you hit on a couple of things, and I'm curious on how you guys made these decisions of, you know, when you, so you're growing, it's consuming cash. And then I think, you know, that you mentioned that you enjoyed sales and it was fun, which I think is one of the dynamics of trying to delegate and let go, right? I mean, but then there's also, I think there's this financial decision that has to be made of, are we willing to invest when we're already starving for cash, someone that's going to be 120 grand, even though we would like to make 150 consistently. It's a financial decision to invest to hopefully get that return, even while you're also cash strapped. And then, if you love it, it's probably even a better excuse to not let go. Versus if you hate it, you kind of might, you know, swallow that golf ball before you should otherwise. Yeah. So curious on how did you guys? Does that make sense? I don't know if you got any insights on that.
Two things, and if I'm off base, you can let me know. But the first is, how do you go about making the decision to hire somebody that's going to make as much or more than you make to put the business to the next level up? And that's usually one of the big considerations, one we wrestled with a lot. How do you get talent coming on board? And, you know, strategically, we had to make a decision of what is our line of sight? What is our vision, near term and long term? Is this as good as it gets, or do we see a bigger opportunity for a bigger future for ourselves and our people? And we were all in on the fact that, yeah, this has some real legs. We were one of the first companies to have, it sounds kind of corny right now because everything's so commonplace, but to have an interactive portal where our clients could see exactly where the work in progress was. You know, back in 1995, if you had like a spinning globe on your website, that was pretty cool.
Flash player, woo.
Right, yeah. But we were pumping tons of cash into building out an interactive system, an operating system behind. We would have gladly bought one off the shelf. There just wasn't anything at the time. Mm-hmm. So we made the choice to make a big investment in systems. That was the first major cash outlay of our focus. The second was in talent, where this is a lesson early on, where which is a mistake, but what we hired for was people from the industry that had a track record with, you know, their database of names. That was kind of the big three. And we were so excited to have an industry veteran come along. It's a huge mistake.
I was going to say, explain that, because I actually was talking to Gary Braun, who's a sales consultant here in town. And he was talking about, you know, again, we talk about everybody wanting to hire the Rolodex from the competitor. Yeah. And a lot of people do that. Why was it a mistake for you guys?
Well, so first of all, nobody, this Rolodex, this database that they say they're bringing across, nobody ever jumps ship. None of the clients that they say they know, it just doesn't happen, right?
Right.
It just doesn't happen that fast. You may have one or two because they're mad at something else and they'll go with you because the timing is right. But nobody drags all that across the line. And just because they know them doesn't mean they're going to make a change. The other thing industry veterans tend to bring with them is baggage. And, you know, we did it this way at IBM. We did it this way at Black Box or, you know, whatever the big company was. Well, you know what? When you're, you know, a 50-person startup and you guys are working, you know, 10 hours a day, it's a different game. So we had much better luck as we started to get more scientific about it, hiring for a good cultural fit, you know, for people that had a great work ethic. You know, they may have been farm kids, but they were good on a computer, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you can teach almost any skill, but work ethic's a tough thing. You know, it's tough to swing around. And so once we started to get alignment with that, you know, we looked to our friends, we looked to the colleges we came from, we looked to people we could draw a line of where we knew good quality people were coming from. So I hired my brother, who was awesome, did a great job for us. Brian was fantastic. We hired some other guys that were from different universities around the area. And you know what? They were young. They weren't super expensive at the time. And it made a huge difference, and they were all committed to it. eventually, you know, we had to step up our game. And as the stakes grow, then you do have to hire some talent that has a bigger paycheck attached to it. And that's also a big consideration.
So when you were looking at, and as you're hiring the people and investing in the systems, and you had found kind of your knack of give us the worst, knowing that you do strategic planning now, Todd, like, you know, I'm assuming like if you were to look at like, you know, all the different models of how to make choices and decisions in your strategic plan, you know, you probably would have come up with something like this, but how did that fit into your accelerated growth because of how, you know, focused the decision was? And then how does that tie into the rule of five? I don't know if they were tied together.
Yeah, it was very much tied together because early on, like a lot of businesses, look, we chased anything that looked like it had a technology edge that we thought we could help with, we'd jump on. And here's the problem. When you're dealing with subcontractors, you're already a middleman. And so that markup is going to be a big deal. And if you're doing local work, well, you know what? You're going to price yourself out of the market. So as we were chasing things around, we were moderately successful. But what we sat down and took a look at is where do our best clients come from? Where are the ones that really appreciate the work we do, that pay us well, and are willing to rave about us to others? And so this is where that rule of fives came up. So what we did is we drew a hard line and said, this is all we're going to chase. And so we started with the idea of they have to have at least 50 locations, which means they have some geographic spread. And that meant that our ability to organize was meaningful. Mm-hmm. That means they had to have at least 5,000 people because having bodies use technology, bodies use phones, use computers, use all kinds of things, and they have to be able to communicate. So that was impactful. And $500 million in sales. They had to be big enough where they would want to spend the money to do these bigger, probably more capital-intensive projects that we were actually very good at. Mm-hmm. So that was the bare bones of what it took off as. And that's kind of more demographic speaking. And look, if it was just that easy, you can go pull a list for pennies on the dollar and it rains new business. And you and I both know that's not the way it goes. But it was a starting point. It was a good way to get us focused on what we're going to chase.
And say no.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent point. Until you're willing to say no to something, it's really not a strategy, is it?
That's a really, yeah, totally. And saying no is very hard, especially when you're chasing cash.
Yeah. You know who's the hardest person to say no to, Ryan?
My wife, but other than that.
Okay. She's probably number two. The hardest person to say no to is yourself.
Hey, no, you're probably right. You're probably right. Yeah.
Because we have all these great ideas. Oh, this would be gross. This would be great. You know, and without somebody that was a good litmus test. And I'd say Al and Jeffrey were a great litmus test for that. It's like, that's a crazy idea. That's never going to work. Or, you know, let's roll the dice on that. And so I totally valued my partners from that standpoint. Is they were just such clear thinking guys, even to this day, just very, very thoughtful about what we wanted to do. And to your point, we had to say no to a lot of things to chase after what was worth it.
So then as you're like in your growth journey here, like where did it start to like, because it kind of, you know, as you said that you had a buy sell agreement, then I don't know if you had a shotgun clause in there, and you can feel free to elaborate on that. Like as the ownership, and like obviously you didn't leave 50% for future people or different things or, you know, investors. How did that conversation come up? Like what was a triggering point in the growth where you guys actually started to have that?
So about 5 years into it, we got to a point where we're experiencing significant growth. Things were going really well. We were moving fast, but a growing business is a hungry cash animal. And we were at a point where we needed to put in cash and we were going to use our own money to do it. And, you know, Al and I were said, this is it. This is where we want to go. It's worth investing in. I want to bet on myself. So we were going to put our own cash in. Jeffrey, our third partner, so he was 10 years older than us. His wife had passed away. So he was really carrying the ball for the whole family and his boys. So I had ultimate respect for him.
Yeah.
But he was at a point, he's like, dudes, I can't keep hitting the gas like this. We're just burning ourselves out. Yeah. And I'm 10 years older. I want to step back. And we're like, okay, well, we're all in on this. I know you're not. Let's figure out how we use the language in our agreement and go through the buy sell. And, you know, is relatively simplistic in terms of, I think you take a multiplier of 3 times last year's, 2 times year before, and 1 times year before, and you kind of average those out to get a valuation. That was the simple math we did. And long and short of it was, We all agreed to it. None of us was happy. We thought we paid him too much. He thought he got too little. So it was probably the right number.
If everybody's upset, that means everybody won.
Yeah, we're all equally angry with the deal. But it, you know, and he walked away fine, and you know, and it was the right thing to do. We gave him some freedom. He got money to be able to enjoy himself and have a good time. And Al got a chance with me to be able to go and double down on what we thought was a really good bet on ourselves.
So, okay, like this, I want to peel this situation apart. Not necessarily the situation apart, but what happened with your guys' mindset? Because one is, just for clarification purposes for the listeners, is when you say you looked at the multiple, so if it was three times, you were talking, did you normalize the EBITDA? So you cleaned it all up and said, okay, if this was ongoing, this would be the cash flow would be like, and then you applied the 3, 2, and 1 to the last handful of years and normalized it. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. So you take normalized EBITDA, you know, outside of anything else that would be abnormal or one-time occurrences. And then we kind of agreed, here's what we're going to count, here's what we're not going to count. You kind of back into it from there. But, you know, the clean thing about something like that, and there's lots of ways to do it, right? But the clean thing about that is we knew from day one what that would look like. And it put the emphasis on this last year while still giving some credit for the previous years in declining order.
How about any future years?
It did not take that into account, because our assumption was once you stop rowing the boat, you know, it's other people's horsepower.
Yep. Which makes sense. And unless you do the only, for partnership buyouts, I'd agree. But if you're going to be selling it to like a private equity firm or something like that, which we're going to get into, you want to be selling future potential, right?
So, 100%. And, you know, when you talk into private equities, that's what they're buying, right?
If
they're going to cut you a check, they expect it's going to be worth more in 3 to 4 years. Otherwise, why do it?
Yep. So when you guys go through this, but you know, just a couple of clarifying questions on the deal structure. Did you go to a bank to pay them out? Did you go do seller financing? What was the structure like?
I'm trying to think of how that worked out. I think we took part of it out of cash on hand. I'm not sure if we took any out of our own pockets, but it's possible. And then we had a short-term buyout that only lasted maybe probably another year or so, so we could pay some out of cash forward proceeds.
So then the question that I wanted to get to is, did you and the remaining partner, was there any kind of shift in your mindset to going, okay, I kind of understand this whole value creation versus annual income thing, right? I mean, like, was there a shift in your mindset, and did that help bring any kind of clarity into why you were going to be doubling down and what you eventually wanted down the road?
Yeah, actually, that's a good point, because at that point, once you start laying out your own cash for something that is not going to be anything you can hold or handle for quite some time, you start to say, okay, what are we putting money towards that for us too is going to be worth more in the future? And it became very clear that, you know, we're taking a look at overall profitability, taking a look at what were we going to put capital towards it, taking a look at what were we willing to spend money on from a talent acquisition standpoint, and all that became front and center in every conversation.
Did you guys start talking about like what end result might be for you guys, or was it more just what are we going to invest in for the growth strategies?
So for that point in time, it was really more about the growth, because we could see that, you know, again, huge opportunities, a lot. We had just kind of barely in our minds started to scratch the surface. But if you fast forward a few more years, then we got to the point of saying, so I picture it like playing at a blackjack table, right? So Al and I are sitting there and we're crushing it. We're winning hand after hand and doing great. And so the chips are piling up, but the casino will not let you take chips. You got to stay and keep playing that same thing. Yeah. And you know, sooner or later, you're going to run up against a dealer 21, and that's tough. And so we started to get two things in mind as we were moving forward. One is, look, we're growing. This is healthy, but 100% of our cash is going into the business, with the exception of, you know, enough to keep a roof over our heads and pay taxes. And we're like, what would it be like if, one, we could take some chips off the table, and two, we also saw opportunity for acquisitions. So there was other things out there, and we knew we didn't have the cash to be able to do that. So that's when we started having conversations about outside capital and what would that look like, and that's when we started to move forward a few years into it. And again, we took three different passes at it, which I'd be happy to explain, before we ended up with a group of investment bankers that we really kind of went through our acquisition with, went through our sale with.
Why don't you expand on that? I'd love to hear it.
the first two were bombs. The first two were horrible. So
there were three because the first two sucked.
That's right. So, and they happened over a sequence of years. It wasn't like they were back to back, but the very first time we went through, we were super naive. And we had gotten introduced to this other group and they had a really slick pitch and telling us how awesome we were. And, you know, for a big check, they were going to make all these great things happen. And what long and short, what came out of it is they put together these really nice kind of encyclopedia hardcover books about our business. We're like, wow, this is amazing. People are going to love us. And then zero follow through. There was like, you know, I don't even know what they did. They probably bought us lunch and that was it. But there was nothing that ever came of it. We're like, that was a total waste. This is investment banking.
How much did you pay for that?
I'm thinking it was 50 grand.
Oh my God. We have the same story. These guys, Madison Street Capital out of New York, these bankers in suits came and they flew out. They like made us feel like rock stars. And then they're like, hey, Ryan, all you have to do is you write this 100-page document.
Yeah.
You give us 40 grand. And then we'll take you to market. We did all that and they never called us back.
That was it. Yeah. I think they hardbound covered our, you know, our printout and that was it. I was
cashed
like,
a check and said, see you later.
Yeah. Yeah. So same experience, same wonderful result. So that was a swing and a miss. Later we did it with a group out of Texas. And, you know, it was one of those things we didn't line up and we didn't do enough due diligence to say, okay, well, where's the fit? How are we going to get along? Because you already know this, but you spend a ton of time with the investment banker, broker, whoever you're going to be with. So you better get along. And they were nice enough, but he wasn't super engaged and he was older and this is kind of a last pass for him. So we probably met with a few different private equity companies, but there was nothing exciting. And I don't think they had a good engagement plan for getting the right audience in front of us. And, you know, I look at it that way. They'd probably look at it like those guys didn't know what they were doing and on and on and on. So, point of view, right?
So then out of the, was that over the course of like a year or so? I mean, like, was there outside pressures? Because obviously taking chips off the table is a nice to have and a want, right? And then, or was it like the growing pains were getting so hard at this point where you were just saying, okay, we need an equity partner to infuse this with some cash?
So, you know, what would have probably happened is we'd probably had to get off the accelerator because we're growing at like 25% year over year. And, you know, we kept breaking our leases with our where we had our offices. Mm-hmm. And we'd sign the shortest lease we could, like every 3 years would be the shortest one we could get. And like a year and a half in, we'd have too many people and then we'd have to break the lease and then they would upsell us to someplace else, you know, 3 miles away. And so they were fine with it because they were making more money, but we're like, this is expensive. This is getting really expensive. And so, yeah. So if you're talking about outside pressures, it was probably more internal about like, how long can we keep this up to be able to make it go? And you know, I'll give Al credit. I'll give Teresa, you know, our CFO credit. They're super smart as far as we never got too far out over our ski tips. We never got heavy in debt. That's kind of that whole Midwestern, mm-hmm. if you can't pay cash for it, you shouldn't buy it. So for better, for worse, that was the way we operated, which is really tough in a growing business. You know, so we got to that point of where like, we got to figure something out and we did see some opportunities. So you take chips off the table and you look for opportunity for equity and that's what kept pushing us down. And so we'd wait a year or two, take another look, wait a year or two, swing and a miss in Texas. And then, you know, then probably like the 04 range, we got serious about things.
So then how did you, after those two swing and misses, what was the process? And then how did you pick the next investment banker?
So the third process, we decided, let's take the smartest people we know that have had some history with an exit and ask them about what their experience has been, who they recommend, who they not recommend. And we kept going around and talking to as many people as we could. And we kind of triangulated as best as we could. And we came up with a group called Green, Holcomb, and Fisher, a Twin Cities group. And it was really important to us to be able to look them in the eye, shake their hand, and be close to them as often as possible. So that was a big deal. And Eric Nicholson was the quarterback for our deal with Kyle Crow and Mike Rapetti. And they were awesome. They were great. They were everything you could hope for in a deal team, in an investment banker. And they were very honest with us early on about, you know, I don't know what you guys think the business is worth, but here's what the world says. Here's your kind of range, right? And so that's kind of the first trick that we learned is when we interviewed other investment bankers, some of them shoot a number to you like, oh my God, that's outrageously cool. It's like, you got zero shot at that. Zero shot.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So once we got a dose of reality, we found guys we could work with, could get along with, and then they went to market. And you know, honestly, we were thinking, Al and I were talking about, we're like, God, you know what? If they found like 12 companies that would be interested in us, wouldn't that be awesome? And, you know, you're kind of happy about it, but that was our first pass at really getting deeper into it. Fast forward, and we had 200 companies come back to us with, we're interested. We want in on this. We want to know more. We want to interview the management team. We're like, oh my God. Had we not had like good representation and a good buffer between us, we'd have been overrun. We'd have never been able to keep our eye on the ball for the business.
That so you hit on quite a few things there that I want, and then I want to dive into the process. But like, so because so many times, like literally, actually, the guy that I just interviewed, he said like, he goes, if you do not keep your eye on the ball, this is like a second full time job, and how much work it is. So yeah. When you were interviewing or working with investment bankers, was there anything? Was there major insights that they gave you that were helpful as you started analyzing these deals, so that you weren't completely shocked at like all the different decisions that you're going to have to make?
Yeah, there's two things that I vividly remember. The first is, and this is literally the best advice I ever got, and this is from Eric, and he said, "Be happy with what you get on the first pass." You know, because they always talk about second bite of the apple or rolling equity and that. He said, because after the first pass, it's not yours to control anymore. And all those decisions, you might have a hand in it, but it's not the same level of control. So be happy with what you get on the first pass. That was huge. And that stayed in our mind, which meant how much cash is going to be for us in the deal. The second thing, and this became really important as we started to vet the other side, as they became more serious about it, that is, companies buy for their own reasons, right? They'll tell you whatever, right? They're going to tell you you're awesome. They're going to tell you we can take you to the moon. But they buy for their own reasons. So sometimes it's purely financial. They think that they can do their own financial model and it's going to grow at this rate and therefore you're worth this much. That's the financial. And then you have the strategics that come in and say, you know, if we add you into our mix for doing the things that we don't do well, we can 1+1 = 3 kind of deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so all these different things. And what I asked Eric, completely naive, and said, Eric, don't we just take the guy that gives us the most money? Isn't that the deal? He goes, well, you know, that is a part of it, but that's not the only part, because these guys that are giving you a check today are going to be your partners tomorrow. How are you going to figure out how are you going to get along? And so, but that became a long conversation as well.
So you just like shed light on all the stuff I was getting. I love it. I love it because, you know, in we got our five principles, and the first one is your drivers, which is knowing what you want. And it literally is not about the check. And I've got hundreds of interviews to prove that.
Yeah.
And like, so as you have 200 people coming to you, one part of this is curious on how, like, the role the investment bankers played to help you guys with that. But then also, as you and your partner, like, the dynamics, Todd, is like you and your partner might want different things. So I don't know if you guys ever aligned like what you both wanted besides just the check, but also like your role and responsibility going forward. But how did you analyze the difference of these offers that were coming down the table without, you know, like in relationship to the money, right? Because there's, mm-hmm. I mean, when people talk, I've never built a house, but I'm friends with people that have built a house, and and like the fact that most of them are married still is apparently a miracle
because
the decision fatigue, right? So like when you and your partner are getting all of these things thrown at you, how are you weighing the different offers on the table?
So again, each offer is unique, and they did tell us they're all going to look different. And I didn't believe him at the time, but he was right. So I would say this is the magic of a great investment banking or broker partner, is that they were the ones that early on started to shape down 200 to something that probably early stages, they were quick to squeeze out, I'll say 150 of them, just to give you a round number, to say, look, here's how many people are in the deal. These are what the numbers, these are what the ranges are starting to look like. Are you still in? And, you know, get plenty of people that are just interested because they want to either pull data or they're kicking tires or whatever. Mm-hmm. But as they saw, like, that there were serious buyers starting to come in, and things were jumping up, you'd get people that they would naturally squeeze out. So there was a good attrition rate, and that was really their early magic of being able to do that. So then you get down to your group and you start having some exchange of ideas. And then they want to know, okay, what is Todd and Al, what is your plan for the future? How are you going to make this business more valuable? And then we told them, and said, you know, here's how we see things growing, potentially through acquisition, but also through, we have a strategic advantage in our technology because with all these people doing thousands and thousands of interactions with us, we have all of their history. So even though, you know, Phyllis, who may be working in your IT department, has been tracking, you know, your whole West Coast for years, when she leaves, we're still going to know what is and isn't going on. So that was valuable. So we kept pushing that up. And, you know, we saw a much bigger future. And that was kind of the alignment between me and Al. It wasn't like, hey, we're going to take a check and we're going to cut and run. This is like, no, we need somebody that's going to help us build this into something really cool. What could this thing become? What could we really push it towards? And that was exciting.
So did you notice in the different buyers, people that actually, because I think aligning that vision is the hardest part, and probably any handoff of a baton, especially a private equity recap where like you're going to be partners with these people, is someone believing what you believe and not just totally bullshitting you. So like, how did you find like what, you know, maybe tell, I don't know if you can compare and contrast of event, you know, the venture one that you picked versus people that you could tell were not in alignment with you guys?
Yeah. So if I forget, you can remind me to tell you about the people buy for their own reasons and why did they buy. Yeah. So catch me on that if I forget. But so, you know, Al and I, as we sat down and said, okay, what do we want when we get out of this? It's like, we still want to be in control making decisions in the company. We're happy to have partners, but we still want to be able to drive this thing forward. We want to be in a leadership position. And we still wanted to focus on national accounts that had geographic spread and all those things. And so we didn't want to like dive into it. Hey, let's own the Toledo market or something like that. It was still on that path. But we also saw a bigger opportunity. So we were kind of, I'll just say, voice centric early on, but data and, you know, data and internet and those kind of connectivity issues became a much bigger story to tell going forward. Mm-hmm. You know, phones almost a throwaway. In fact, you go to a lot of offices, people don't even have phones. They just, you know, mobile now.
Yep.
But data is still a big deal. And so we wanted to make sure they had that in mind. And then you kind of quickly catch people. So a lot of strategics, we were a very narrow fit for a certain thing. And it was either a fit or it wasn't a fit. And early on, I think, honestly, when I look back on the contract that we signed with Green Holcomb Fisher, you know, we kept saying, oh, it's going to be these guys. It's going to be one of these three strategics. And they're like, oh, okay. And we're like, well, we don't want to pay you full price if it's one of these. And they're like, yeah, absolutely, boys. Let's make a space for those three names and we'll give you whatever, 25% discount or something significant if it turns out to be something you already knew about. We're like, okay, we can live with that. Well, the long and short of it, they were nowhere in the lineup. They were just, you know, and for all kinds of different reasons, right? You don't know what they're going through. One of them had just done a major acquisition and was totally consumed with that. The other one was going in a different strategic direction. We didn't know that because we're not in their board meetings, right? And then the third one, it just wasn't a fit for them. And so all three of those that we were so all fired concerned with, this is going to be the deal, not even a shot. But thank God that they had this large basket of other companies that were interested. And so once Al and I started saying, here's what we really want of the deal, now you get down from 50 and now you get down to, you know, maybe 12 to 15 that were super serious about it. And, you know, this is when you kind of final beauty contest. What's your best offer? What are you going to do? What does it look like? And this is when you get into that whole mix of cash and rolled equity and what else are they going to do to sweeten the deal and what do you have to offer? And that's when everything really does look very different. And so then
maybe this ties back into people buy for their own reasons.
Yeah.
I think the biggest challenge of anybody that has not gone through this, which is the art, like, I mean, essentially what I've been preaching for five, six years is like, you have to understand this, even if you have no intentions for 12 years to sell, like understanding that, like, you know, not only what's important to you, how to layer that on top of the financial structure, which I want you to dive into, like the, you know, the rolled equity versus cash versus promissory notes versus probably your roles, but then also what the buyer's going to do with your business and how that aligns with what you want. Because
Those are a lot of different things to align to be able to analyze 12 different offers. Because if you went straight for the top dollar amount, that's different than the deal structure and different for what the heck they're going to do with the business and your role post-closing.
Yep, 100%. And so so if people are listening and they're listening, I would highly recommend. I haven't had a chance to. I'm looking forward to attending one of your boot camps. I think it'd be great. But from the concepts you and I talked about, I think it's hugely helpful for people to get a very firm construct in their mind about what does it look like now? What am I offering? What do I need it to look like on the other side of the deal?
Yeah, right.
And that's the point you're making, which I think is super valid. And to have something in play with that is very important. So I'm going to start with the people buy for their own reasons conversation. So we ended up with a private equity group out of Cleveland called Morgan Thaler. And they were one. So it was, I don't know if it was the top dollar, but it was up there. And then they also had this other piece of it, which was there's the second bite of the apple. So there's rolled equity. And the big thing that they said, hey, and we have these other two companies. You're going to make an amazing platform company. We have these two bolt-ons, which is, you know, just kind of PE speak for you're going to be the main guys, and we're going to have these other companies become like subsidiaries or, you know, stepchildren of yours, right?
And love, so we're love like, the analogy.
Yeah. So yeah. So it's like, you know, you start and, you know, we're, let's just round it out, call it 30 million. And you add on these other two companies, we're going to double in size overnight, right? And we're like, oh my God, that is unbelievable. And we're thinking this is the coolest thing in the world because now we're really legit. We're big. We're going to have all the structure. They had government contracts. That's what they were good in. We weren't good in that. We did national companies, on and on. So we were kind of feeling that was great. And then they also said, hey, we're hands off, right? So your listeners probably already know, but you know, I have active management, passive management, that kind of thing. They were going to be passive management versus the guys that want to come in and you know, roll up their sleeves and get deep into your business. So we were happy about that. And, you know, the obvious part about the whole thing is, you know, we would still be in control of a bigger entity with lots of opportunity. And that was exciting. So strip that back and you see it from the other side of the table. And here's the truth, right? They did have two companies. They did have two companies, one of which was in financial freefall. So
we see
a number, but it was a shadow of what it used to be. So, you know, there's the saying in the investment banking world of catching the falling knife. This was catching the falling knife. And so we only saw where they are today, and neither business had a CEO. It's like a ship without a rudder, both ways.
Oh my gosh.
And so they sold it to us on, oh, this is awesome because we won't have any leadership conflict. You guys just take over. Like, of course, because there's no leaders, right?
Yeah. So like we need you guys really bad, but we're not going to tell you that.
Yeah. So desperate for a date, but don't want to look desperate. And so that became the deal. And that's a big part of what worked out. We took a problem off of their hands. And this is a lesson that I would pass on to, you know, if it's strategic in any way versus bare bones financial and that's it. If it's strategic in any way, you need to find out what problem are you going to solve for them before you get any money passing hands. What problem are you going to solve? That was the problem that we solved.
You need to repeat that because like that is like honestly like one of the huge things that we discuss and I'm talking about all the time is like if it's anything besides numbers, there's what I like to call the black swan. You don't know what it is. So say it again. It's so important.
So you need to understand as the seller, what problem are you going to solve for them? If you can't figure that out, don't do the deal. Because it'll go badly. I would promise you it'll go badly if you can't figure that out. And, you know, we learned a lot in the process, right? So we had to downsize those other businesses. We kept part of it. We had to shutter part of it. It wasn't a happy time from a Morgan Thaler standpoint, but they got it. This wasn't a problem that we got into, but it was a lot of shuffling after the fact. So that was an important lesson learned.
And by the way, you're going to have to take this. I had a gentleman that I interviewed on the podcast and he said, so he called his lessons learned tuition payments.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, lots of tuition payments. I've got millions of dollars in education.
That is a perfect way to put it. And probably makes us all sleep better at night because it's the investment we make in our future. But he's right. Yeah.
So it's so important. So you're saying that so you and your partner got enough up front to the first pass where you guys were both happy with the financial situation?
Yeah. So it was an 80-20 split. You know, we rolled 20% equity, 10% each. And that was fine. And we really did believe in the company. And quite honestly, if you're going to work with private equity and you're going to go for a sale, if you're not willing to work and roll equity, they're not going to be interested.
Right.
Because, you know, that's you showing you have faith in what you built and what they're buying. If you don't have any faith in it, why should they spend a dollar?
So once, as you're kind of in cleanup mode now, like what was, like you and I talked on the phone last time, and I, you know, there's something that I think you heard kind of some truth in of like, where do they get their money and what's their time horizon? So how did, right? Yeah. wish I would have known those questions, right?
Yeah. Not all handy learned information to have. Yeah.
So like, where did they get their money? What was their time horizon? And then how did that impact what you guys, your new strategic plans, and then how did that all unfold?
So great questions to ask. Those would have been, I think in the process they were, you know, on average, I've understood them to be about 10-year runs, right? So we, private equity, we're going to go out and get, we're going to raise $200 million for this kind of businesses, and it's, we'll get it back to you within 10 years. And that means that somewhere the hold pattern becomes 3 to 5 years for private equity.
For the individual companies inside of that big fund.
Correct. Yep. Yeah. Yep. So like our company, Comworks, they were going to, you know, without saying it, you know, they always say, oh, it could be a long run, could be this, could be that. But the reality is 3 to 5 years.
When the numbers work.
When the numbers work. Yeah. If we're still pumping cash out or they can't find a buyer, those are usually the two reasons. So they were midway through because they'd already done these other two acquisitions and, you know, they were kind of floating around there. So we were probably within the last 3 years of when they really had to get serious about closing things out. You know, that's when you got to make some big things happen. I would totally advise any of your listeners to say those are perfect early entry questions when you're dealing with private equity. Is, you know, sometimes it's family money. So if you think about private offices or family mm-hmm. offices, they have a little bit different trajectory. They all talk buy and hold, but they still trade in and out of businesses. Mm-hmm. It's just a little longer horizon. But yeah, private equity, 3 to 5 years is usually pretty standard. And that was kind of, we're on the tail end of that. So it wasn't discussed at the time, but they were gonna plan to make something happen pretty quick. And so, yeah, so then we closed the deal. We moved forward, figured out what we got. We did our speech to the employees. Key people had already known about it. We had phantom stock options for key people. So they were all vested in a good return. And that was helpful to the cause. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so then we told these our people, they were all, you know, pretty shocked. But the, you know, the beauty of it was, and we were very honest with this, is like, look, this is going to help to ensure a brighter future for all of us, and specifically for you people. You know, we want to have continuity for all of you, and this is a way to make sure that happens. So it's a bigger future for everyone, and we're very honest about that, and that is the truth.
Yeah,
and
then, can I ask you a question? Did
for sure.
Did, which I'm assuming you believed all that right away, did that change at any point where you'd no longer believe that and it felt gross saying it?
That this was a bigger future for all of you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can tell you exactly to the day when that happened. We, you know, we had gone around right after we met our the Washington DC company and the Boston company and did that. And that's when we started to understand what was or wasn't there. But if you want to jump to kind of the headlines of the next part, if you go by Inc. standards, Inc. Magazine, Inc. 500 standards, the average CEO lasts 6 months after transition for a number of good reasons. I think mine was almost 6 months to the day.
So the question is, what happened?
So what happened is this. Everything started to change, right? We're managing other businesses. We didn't have any coaches. We didn't have anyone other than the board, which are private equity people, which are very smart financial people. And private equity is generally the either were lawyers, they were bankers, or they were accountants. That's kind of their world. You know, the high touch people skills, that's not their thing. What we could have really used was some good coaching to say, here's how you manage people, here's how you work with, you know, new opportunities like that, all those different things. And so as we're kind of working through it, we started to realize this is a lot to take on. We were totally up for the challenge. Here's something else that happens in the private equity world. The board of directors, the guys that, you know, did the deal and sat on the thing and said, we're going to be with you. We're in this with you. We're going to ride it with you. The board changed. within a very short amount of time, within just a couple months after we had come on, you know, one guy retired, a couple others moved off, that whole scene changed. They brought in a new chairman of the board, super smart guy. Actually, it's still, I still like him. I still enjoy him, but he was a General Electric GE guy, right?
Oh, there you go.
GE has a playbook. And, yep. And here's how we run that.
Bottom 10%. Get rid of them. Drain the swamp.
Yeah. And so we were actually still growing and doing good. We were battling with two other ships that we were trying to write in the process. But he sat me down and he goes, hey, look, I'm really looking for kind of a Ivy League Harvard guy that's already run, you know, $250 million business. I was like, dude, you know what you bought. It was like, you can't change that. And he says, I know, and it's uncomfortable to say, but what we really need is a big time CEO to run a big time company. You're not that guy.
How did you feel about that?
Crushing. Crushed. I was like, I had no intention of doing anything other than driving this thing to the next level. And, you know, it's one of those things, you go home and you're a failure. How am I going to tell my wife? You know, luckily my kids, you know, they were young. All they cared about was, am I going to go play ball with them in the front yard? But, you know, for all the friends, what do you tell them? So much of our identity is wrapped up in the business. It was just brought me to my knees.
How did you process that, Todd? Because this is the challenge that I think so many people that have been on the show, when they have that happen to them, they're like, I wish we wouldn't have sold, and I wish we would have done things differently.
Yeah. So, okay. So two thoughts on that. First is, the question that I ask myself and what lets me sleep at night is this. I said, knowing what I know now, I even had this conversation with my wife, Leslie, yesterday. I said, knowing what I know now, all the things that transpired and what happened and what we got out of the deal, where the company went, what's going on, would I do the deal today or would I have done it back then if I knew what I knew today? And the answer is yes. It was the right thing to do for the right time. And so hard as that was, it was the right thing for everybody involved. Not awesome from a personal fulfillment standpoint on my end, but it was the right thing.
And how did you process that then? Like, because like intellectually you can understand that. It doesn't matter sometimes where you're just like, still, that sucks.
Yeah. So I will say, so here's what's helpful to the cause. I will say, had I had a good coach, that would have been super helpful to the cause, because there's some things that are really hard to talk about if they haven't experienced what you've experienced and if they haven't been where you are. And having somebody that's a good partner is a huge difference maker. That would have been good. The next best thing I would say is a great peer group. And I had a great peer group of other entrepreneurs that I got together with regularly. And they were hugely supportive. And they'd all kind of gone through their own iterations of that. And so that was probably the most therapeutic part of the process.
Mm-hmm. So then what was the arrangement? Because you rolled 20%, I'm assuming a large check, into the business.
Yeah.
And they're halfway through their fund, and that was a long time ago. So I know we're kind of running a little short on here on time, but how did that all unfold, knowing that, like, okay, you're emotionally kind of wounded and now you've got some financial stake in this machine. Your partner's still there. So how did that all unfold?
Yeah. So I could have been a big baby about the whole thing and just train wrecked it all. Right. And just made a mess of it. You don't have any cause. This isn't in the contract. You're not going to do this, on and on and on. I ended up saying, if this is good for the company, if this is what's best for the company, then I'm going to do what's best. Now, the downside is my equity with 20% that, you know, my part is hostage. And now I don't have, you know, I have a board seat, but that's, you know, that's not the same leverage that you'd like to enjoy as a leader. You know, in the whole process, and this, I think, is a misstep on their part, because they went out for this massive search for Harvard MBA that's run a $250 million company. And the ones they loved didn't love them. And the ones that wanted the job weren't good enough for them. So they had this mismatch. And I think, personally, I think they did a horseshit job of the handoff. Mm-hmm. But they made Al, the CEO, said, just go ahead and take it. And what they should have done is make it the big deal that it deserved to be for him, because he was willing to step up. He was willing to do that. And he's a hell of a leader and a great guy. And they should have made a bigger deal about, hey, he's the man. We're going to let him do this.
So after all that, literally, Al ended up being the partner. So how long was the timeline after them trying to find and having that mismatch where they ended up making Al the partner?
You know, so it's probably as long as an executive search takes. I'm going to guess it was several months, but it was one of those things that it was very unceremonious, and I think it deserved to be something more for such kind of a big transition.
Well, especially for like, you know, I mean, I'm assuming you would kind of process it at this point. Thank God. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. It's still hard.
It took a full 30 days worth of just, you know, going on long runs and letting my dog be a good listener and working with a peer group and that. But, you know, before the venom cleared, but then, you know, it stays with you for a while. It was such a big part of your life for a long time. It's hard to eject that all.
I can't even imagine. I mean, I had one of my old employees call me up and ask about this previous employee that from like literally 9 years ago, Todd, was one of the most toxic people I've ever met. And like to this day, it bubbled all this stuff up. And I'm like, wow, I haven't felt that in a long time. Holy cow. I guess that's not fully processed.
It's amazing how that stuff lays dormant like a virus and just comes booming back.
I was like, well, got that out.
Yeah. Therapeutic.
Oh, and especially when you're dealing with something like that, where you got to process it, and it wasn't rewarded to Al like it could have been, right? So it was kind of like the worst of both scenarios.
Yeah.
So then, what did they do? Did they sell again? And how did the rest of the story kind of pan out?
Yeah. So you know, I stayed on the board for a while. I think I was connected to them. Geez, I should know this more, but I think it was like a 3-year hitch. And I would say average employment agreements range from 3 to 5 years. So it was kind of minimum engagement. I was happy to be done with that.
So they paid you an employment agreement for 3 years, even though you weren't CEO?
Yeah. So, you know, shining light there, you certainly get to explore a lot of things. I took up blacksmithing and learned to play guitar and weird stuff like that.
Well, there you go. Silver lining for sure.
Yeah. Plus the kids were little. I got to be there all the time. And so, you know, that was fun time. You're building snow caves and you're going to, you know, hockey games and all that stuff. So that was great. And then to unwind it though, you know, the equity was still stuck. The equity was still there, but now I was separated from them. And so you kind of fast forward. It was one of those things that things go up and down. You know, we survived the dot-com crash. We survived 9/11, you know, all those different things. And yet, you know, we still got to this point of where things were going up and down. And then the financial crisis hit. And that was a really tough time where they had to go through some significant layoffs. I was gone by then. But it's a tough time, tough thing to have to go through. So kind of fast forward up and down. There were some very short times where, you know, I was still on the board and they were talking about wanting to just close her out, just be done with it, shut it down. And between myself and probably more likely Al and some of the other people, we said, let's make this thing go. This is ridiculous. That's a short-term hiccup. So that kept going. I would say if I had to give a final ending, so that second bite of the apple was really pretty small. So it was, you know, like a token payout, I'll just say. It wasn't a big deal, but they did end up recapitalizing the business and restructured, and Morgan Thaler was able to close out their fund and they went on their way, and they brought in new finance, new partners, you know, new people to the dance. And since then, they've continued to do well. And I think they've made, you know, other acquisitions and things that have continued to bolster
the business. What was it like going through another PE recap? Were you involved in that at all? I mean, even if you were like Al
peripherally, Al was you know, front and center for the whole thing. But I was very much on the outside by then. So that was more or less aligned. Like, are you still wanting to get a check out of the deal? Here's a good way to get a check. Let's be done with this. And I was already thinking about other things. So that worked out fine. But it does go back to Eric Nicholson's point. Hey, man, be happy with what you get on the first pass.
Totally. So then, what, you know, as you were kind of reinventing yourself, I know we could probably do a whole nother podcast on this, but like, what, you know, what was there any tools or any, you said peer group, you said coaching, but like, you know, how did you reinvent yourself to be the point where like you found your identity and passion, and like, how are you recalibrating things differently, knowing that you shouldn't double down your entire identity into one thing?
Yeah. So that was a very clear directive from my wife, Leslie. It's like, we're not going to gamble everything again. We've kind of reached a point where we don't have to do that again. So, you know, with another company that I'd started with some other people that were very good in the business was a company called Sonic, which was a management group designed to help professionalize a lot of these tech companies that were out there. A lot of these people that were our subs that want to know, how do I hire better people? How do I delegate effectively? How do I find better clients? All these questions that Commerce was never designed to answer. And so we built a company around that. We learned a ton. I was able to kind of pour myself into that. And we made them millions and millions of dollars of, you know, helping them grow their business and things like that. And that was really what helped us kind of galvanize, helped me galvanize the things, you know, that I love doing, the things mm-hmm. that still give me energy and the things that get me paid. And so when you kind of find the crosshairs of those things, that...
Say the crosshairs again. I think that was very, very...
So the things you do well, the things that bring you energy and the things that people are willing to pay you for, you know, you really had to get mm-hmm. 3 out of 3 to find something that's a real passion for yourself. Because you may be good at it, but if it's just one of those things, you're like, yeah, I'm good, but I don't love it. It's like sooner or later, things are going to get tough. So if it's not a passion, it's going to be a problem. And you may love it and people may love, you know, doing it with you. But if they're not willing to pay you for it, then it's a hobby and call it a hobby and be okay with that.
Well, and what I find interesting, Todd, is that like when an entrepreneur runs out of the energy and they're, even though they're doing it well and they're getting paid money, that's when they leave a lot of money on the table and they sacrifice this X and they want out, right? And then things go bad. Or when you're doing it well, you're getting paid and you have energy, but then you have a new partner like you did, and then you're yanked out of that situation unwillingly. That also leaves you unhappy. So it's like, it's very hard for me to articulate constantly of like, this word intention has been obviously bubbling a lot to the top in our society, but also that's kind of the name of the boot camp and potentially the new name of the podcast. And it's like, if you understood how this all works, you can continuously refine to make sure that you're always in that nucleus of that the crosshairs, like you said. But it's hard if you don't know these lessons, like you talked about.
Yeah, so I would take your boot camp to be something like, I would picture it like a backstage pass, right? This is what everything looks like on the other side. This is why you're going to do those things that may not make all the sense in the world. This is why stop talking about top line growth, start talking about, you know, what's the value? What's the money you're keeping? You know, those kind of things. And how do you put processes in place that are meaningful? So it's, you know, everyone's not running back to you for how do we do this, Ryan? How do we do that, Ryan? You know, those mm-hmm. are important things. And I think if you talk about intentionality, that's the way I would look at that. And I'm hoping to learn from that when I get to visit with you. But I think it'd be hugely valuable to have that backstage pass before you got in the throes. So the biggest lessons, right? I'm going to go back to kind of the two pieces of advice coming out of it. One, be happy with what you get on the first pass, because after that, you just don't have the same level of control. And the other thing I would say is people buy for their own reasons. And, you know, you need to figure that out when you're making the sale. Because in my experience as an owner and working with, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of other owners that go through it, when you strip everything else away, there are two things that become important. One is certainly the size of the check. The other is the legacy that you're leaving behind that typically represents a decade or two or three or four worth of your life.
So important. And I think being able to weigh, I mean, like literally you're summing up our principles of like, if you understand what you want, then you layer your financial results on top or the financial decisions on top of what you want. And then you've got the ability to articulate for the first time, this legacy is like these decisions are worth this much to me versus like too many times it happens after the fact and you don't know it. And then you're like, oh crap. And I think it's just super, super hard. And to process it, right? When you didn't want to process it.
yeah, absolutely. You're right. I think being able to quantify the bets you're going to make or willing to say no to is hugely important. I would say not everybody's awesome at that. So I think there's value in being able to do it.
So Todd, if someone wants to reach out to you, find your resources, strategic planning, your podcast, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So Dynasty Leadership Podcast is my podcast. I'm looking forward to having you on, Ryan.
Then you can interrogate me.
Exactly. Change seats. You can get me by email, todd@dynastylc.com. So dynastylarrycharlie.com. Or you can get me by phone, 612-845-2000. 2076.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Ted.
Absolutely. It was wonderful, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that episode with Todd. If there's one big takeaway, I think it's really diving into your own education. This is not about exiting your company. This is about understanding the way the world works, why your company would be valued, why people would want to buy it, and then build your own growth plan that allows you to connect all the dots with the exact things that you want, not only for your personal legacy and for your lifestyle, but also for your financial targets, because you have a valuable company that allows you to get what you want no matter what happens to you. Whether you get an out of the blue offer, the economy tanks, it doesn't matter, because you've protected yourself by building a valuable business. Check out one of our 2-day boot camps. It's on the website, arcona.io. I've got the curriculum out there. I'm happy to have phone calls to chat with anybody about what you're going to walk away with. We just had 15 entrepreneurs who went through this boot camp, headed to Arizona, and we're going to be doing one down in Tucson, and we're going to be doing more in Minnesota. So please check them out, and make sure you tune in for next week, where I interview a rock star who really, really gives us a true understanding of what it was like bootstrapping his company up to $120 million and then selling to a private equity firm, and how he learned the difference between strategic buyers and PE firms. I hope you enjoy your week, and I will talk to you next week.